Accession number 27804, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Real 7. Now, we're talking about your time as at 144 Squadron at Hemswell from February 37th. You were there till May 38, really. I'm just looking at some general points. What were your sort of recreations like? Because I know you got very interested in motorcycling while you were at Bicester, but let's talk a bit about motorcycling and how your interest in that developed, because I know it was very important to you and how you spent your time.
Yeah, well, that's true. I was first introduced to the motorcycling business at Bicester with 101 Squadron. The corporal and the armourer, the corporal in charge of the armoury, and a number of the senior LACs were all motorcyclist enthusiasts. So as a young boy, when I got there, I was encouraged, inverted commas, to get involved with the motorcycling club. The carpenter, who lived in the same billets, is Chips Carpenter, he had for sale a 250cc two-stroke Francis Barnett. And the corporal in charge of the billet, Griffin, said, oh, I can fix you up with a motorcycle, he said, if you want to join. It'll only cost a fiver, £5 in old money. So I bought this motorcycle, this Francis Barnett, for a fiver. And the rest of the club members, who were also armourers, of course, they were very encouraging to this young lad. I must have been only about 17 at the time. But they encouraged me, they taught me to drive, and we used to go out regularly as a team, usually on Wednesday afternoon recreation, drive around Oxfordshire, and eventually I got sufficiently qualified and I took my driving test in Oxford itself. In these days, this must have been 1936, the driving instructor didn't ride with you, they just had a number of observers at various points throughout the city centre, and they observed your drill. So I passed my test, and I was part of the club, and I used to go out regularly. And I remember going one Easter, setting off from Bicester, heading for Glasgow on Easter break, I think. And I got as far as Kirtrick Camp, by which time the snow was about a foot 18 inches deep, and I thought to myself, this is no place to be. So I went into Kirtrick Camp and knocked at the guardroom window and said, you know, can you put me up for the night? They were very nice about it, they gave me a billet, and I stayed there for about 48 hours. The weather improved, and I pressed on up to Glasgow, eventually arriving. I think it must have taken me about 10 hours. But I got to Glasgow, and my dad didn't take awfully kindly to this motorcycle, didn't make any comments. So he said, come with me, or what's that effect? And the next thing I realised was I was out in the motorcycling shopping area, and he bought me a brand new 250cc two-stroke Velocette motorcycle. It had, in these days, foot change, lovely motorcycles of mini Rolls Royce of the series. Only cost £32, which I suppose in that day was quite a lot. So, however, I rode this thing all the way back to Bicester and was received with open arms, of course, a new bike. Anyway, when I was finally posted to Hemswell from Bicester, I took off on my Velocette and arrived there. And I hadn't been there very long, and I got the offer of a 350cc upswept camshaft Velocette. It wasn't a new bicycle, but it was very, very powerful, very elegant looking thing. And so I swapped it, or sold it, or did something with it, and took over this 350. It was a great bike. So my colleagues and I, for recreation, if you draw a circle of radius 30 miles around Hemswell, you'd be surprised at the number of towns it takes in. You know, from Grimsby, Doncaster and Grimsby in the north, to Lincoln and Sleaford in the south. You can get out and about quite regularly, and in these days, wouldn't be knocked off at 4 o'clock, apart from the odd guard duty, which wasn't very often, or the odd duty armourer. I used to go out with my colleagues, and the sort of procedure was we would share expenses in these days. For example, a gallon of petrol only cost 1 and 6 pence in old money, and we could go out for half a gallon of petrol, 9 pence, and we could go to the local fish and chip shop and have a fish supper for 6 pence, go to the cinema for about 9 pence. So we did this regularly, go to a local dance. We did this regularly, every night of the week except Friday night, which was a mammy night. We had to clean up the billets first. He was inspecting come Saturday morning. It got so bad that I found, we'll pass it to time. We weren't getting enough sleep. We were out and around too often. But the car park was just adjacent to the billets, and you would always find us either there when we had any spare time. And there was a sort of gradual mini motorcycling club grew up, although it wasn't a motorcycling club per se. It was just a couple of three guys that got together, and we used to go out. So we went out as a group of probably six guys or something of that ilk. But it was great. I mean, it was good time. The only thing about this 350cc motorcycle was that the exhaust pipes, which were what they call upswept, they curved out from the cylinder head in a big sweep and came up underneath the pillion seat, and the exhaust pipe was secured to the cylinder with a flange, a screwed on flange. And unfortunately, this cycle that I had was a bit ancient, it's quite old, and the flange, which was an aluminium fluted finned disc, screwed onto the cylinder head, which was cast iron, and over the passage of years the threads had become stripped, and sometimes on occasion the ring would work loose and the exhaust pipe would drop away, leaving a gap of about 2 inches, and out of this gap used to be produced a three inch flame, which was a heck of a racket. And I was known, the police knew about me, but they didn't know who I was, but they knew about me, and the guys in the billet knew, because they could hear me coming from the village of Curtin Lindsay, which was some 7 miles away. They could hear my cycle coming, and rather coincidentally, that some years later, about 1970, I went to a reunion of Hemswell, and I walked into the bar, and there was two guys at the far end of the bar with their backs to me, and as I walked in the door, they were talking about the guy with the motorcycle that used to make this horrible row. But it was great. I mean, it gave us mobility, and we didn't have any restrictions. We went out in civvy clothes anyway.
Now, when you got to the towns, you'd go to the cinema or dances. You didn't drink then?
Oh, no, we didn't. No, we didn't drink. The night out was usually a dance, if it was a local dance. I used to, in Gainsborough, which is our nearest billet, my colleague and I started taking dancing lessons, ballroom dancing lessons. It was considered the in thing then, and the dancing was held in the church hall, which was directly across the road from a Skipper's fish and chip shop. And so we would turn up on one night a week to this dance class, which started about 7, and go through the 7 till 9, right, 2 hours, and we would go through the routine. The couple that were teaching the dancing were ex-ballroom champions dancers. Frodingham, I think, was the name, or Fotheringham. But to cut a long story short, when we finished the dancing, we hopped across the road to the fish and chip shop, and we got well known in this fish and chip shop. And instead of partaking of our food in the front hall, we were always escorted through to the rear, where we were given the quite royal treatment. And it only cost us about a shilling in old money, 5p, a cup of tea, bread and butter. And that sort of us through. That was a once-a-week
Now, you mentioned the duty armourer. I know some of this duty armourer stuff relates to Bicester, but I think it's still important. Well, what were the duties of the duty armourer?
That's true. Duty armourer's function was pretty stereotyped. You checked all the weapons. When I say weapons, all the rifles and the bayonets and pistols and things, revolvers, and in the armour. You checked the serial numbers, you checked that they were secure, you checked there was no break-in, you checked they were all present and correct. Now, the armoury in the old days was a brick-built building with great bars on the windows, and you were the keeper of the keys, and you had to sign the log twice, at least twice a day, and the orderly officer had to sign it once a day, at least. That was the normal day-to-day, and any armament jobs required on visiting aircraft, for example, if the aircraft wanted signal cartridges or something like that, or had a defect in some shape or form, the duty armourer was summoned and had to go and rectify it. Part of the duty armourer's job was to be with the duty pilot in the watch office, because the duty pilot in these days was responsible for ensuring the aircraft flying safely. There was no radar or communication between aircraft and aircraft and watch office. If an aircraft appeared overhead, you heard it, and it was your responsibility to fire off, believe it or not, a signal rocket, which burst at 800 feet, which indicated to the pilot that there was an airfield below. The pilot didn't necessarily know which airfield, but suffice to say, there was an airfield, and provided he could get himself down through the overcast, he could get in okay. There was also another device called the signal mortar, and that was like a 3-inch mortar that you see the army using, but instead of firing around, it fired a maroon, which was about 3 inches in diameter and about 6 inches long, and this thing was ejected to a height of about 1,500 feet and went off with almost bang. And again, the pilot saw this maroon, he knew he was over an airfield, and he would surmise that the height of the cloud base was in excess of 1,500 feet, and it was still his responsibility to get on the ground. Only once, when I was at Bicester, I seem to remember that we had one lost aircraft, and unfortunately he didn't make it. We had pushed up these rockets and things, but he was quite a long way off course, and it crashed somewhere in Oxfordshire or Hampshire, I don't know quite where it was, but it never came back anyway with the loss of all the crew. But the duty armourer's job was static, basically, because when you change duties or change stations, you still have the same thing to go through. Yeah, you had the armoury to check and the duty pilot's mortars and rockets to fire. I don't remember, quite frankly, what we did at, as far as a duty pilot at Bicester's, at Hemswell was concerned. I know we had an armoury. I remember the armoury, but I can't remember ever standing to or being called in, maybe just unlucky. I can't even remember where the hut was. It must have been out in the front of the hangar somewhere. But that was a duty pilot's lot. It was an interesting job. He always got a late supper and excused other duties whilst he did that for a week. The other thing we did was fire picket, of course.
Now, tell me about fire picket.
Well, it came down once a month or once in 6 or 8 weeks, depending. Just you stood to as fire picket. You remained in the guard room, usually. You kept in the guard room, and you were on call, naturally, for 24 hours. And also, you did a guard duty, which came round about once every 8 weeks, which you had to parade all spivved up with your best blue and go on 2 hours on and 4 hours, carrying a rifle and bayonet, no ammunition. And you had to patrol the hangars and things like that, but it was a bit of a nuisance. You could always get somebody to swap, usually for a few shillings, I can't remember, £5 or something, an old money, if you wanted to go out. But we always had some standing. If you got best turnout, stick man, you got the early shift. That's to say, if the early officer inspecting the guard selected you as a stick man, you were on the early shift from 6 till 8 and then 10 till midnight or something. And the rest of the time was... So you didn't really lose any sleep, except it got very cold in the winter. But that practice prevailed throughout the Air Force. So it happened in the desert as well, same sort of thing.
Any other regular duties or regular events or things that you had while you were at Hemsworth? Because you were there about a year and 3 years.
Yeah, no other things come to mind. At Hemsworth, no, I don't think so. We did, of course, the armors were when there was exercises in like Camera Obscura or Hill's Mirror or bombing, we all mucked in. I mean, the program would come out and the flight sergeant would detail somebody on the bombs and somebody... I should say that in practice bombing in UK, we used to use 8.5 and 11.5 pound smoke bombs. They're all painted white. You've probably seen pictures of them with two green bands on them. And these came from the maintenance units in a great big box of 10 in a box. And we had to fuse them. That's to say, we used to put the detonator in. So you split the bomb in half and you stuck the detonator in and screwed it up again. And then there's offered up to the aircraft, and the safety pins were withdrawn when the aircraft took off. And when it hit the ground, it went off with a bang and a puff of smoke. That was okay in UK. You could go through quite a few of these. But it was overseas, the bombs were shipped out empty. And this was another chore the armourers had to do abroad, was to, I'll come to that later, but when we got abroad, our practice bombing there, we had to fill the bombs before we used them.
We'll come to that.
Yeah.
Anything else about Hemsworth?
We didn't, as I said, I was a part-time air gunner, and I started to build up my experience, followed from what I'd been taught at Bicester by Corporal Brooks. I got to Hemsworth, and I was then AC-2 stroke armour air gunner. I eventually became, sat my trade test in the armoury there and became AC-1.
Now, what was the trade test?
Trade test, that was a practical and written examination. And in February 37, I reclassified AC-1 stock armour air gunner in my trade, aircraft and first class, which meant another 6 or 7 shillings a week pay increase. So I was then getting 28 shillings a week plus my 10 and sixpence for my aircrew thing, which I managed to keep carrying on.
Sounds good pay for them.
Oh, it was excellent. I was extremely well off. The 10 and sixpence a week extra, I allotted straight to my mother, so I never actually saw that. But I had in my hand on payday, the 22 shillings or whatever, 28 shillings subsequently. And I was really, notwithstanding the fact that we wished to go out every night of the week, literally, and run this motorcycle, fully taxed and insured, of course. And it was quite a hectic life, but I was never broke. I might be down to last tuppence, 2 pence in old money, on a Friday morning payday, but I had enough always to purchase a cup of tea and a Kit Kat, which seemed to be the standard fare at the NAFI, come 11 o'clock on a Friday. And I was also fairly flushed in terms of being able to lend my colleagues. And we did do it. Lend my colleagues the odd 5 shillings or 10 bob, even up to corporal rank.
Now, how did you get on with the officers? Well, the pilots, really. I mean, did you see much of them?
We didn't see very much of them, but The flight sergeant fitter in charge of the flight, the aeroplanes, was an ex-flight sergeant pilot. He'd obviously been an NCO pilot and done his time. Chiefy Laug, he was very good. And we had one or two corporal observers. That was the guys who, full-time, and not very many, but they're nearly all wireless people who seconded from ground trades to... we had some good guys. One guy in particular who was OC, he was Flight Lieutenant R.N. Bateson, who became famous subsequently.
He led the
Mosquito Raid on the Hague as one of the... But he was one of our sergeants, our officers. There was also... Yeah, he was posted. He was posted abroad when we got in April. I was nominated in the old days. We used to be nominated for preliminary warning for overseas postings, which you were given. You must have volunteered to go overseas at some stage, but you didn't know when your number was going to be called. So you got a PWR notice, which qualified you for overseas embarkation leave, but you didn't necessarily get posted overseas. You might not come about, it might be cancelled. But I was on the PWR when I was at Hemswell.
So it wasn't the squadron going overseas, it was you?
No, it's individual in these days. I've got it here. I have to check on it. It's here, actually, the dates. So at that juncture, while it was on PWR, back end of April 30, it was May, actually, we embarked, a new squadron was formed, at Hemswell, inverted commas. When I say it was formed on paper, the actual aeroplanes never materialised, but the aeroplanes actually were at Upper Hayford. But the squadron and number, i.e. 113 squadron, was formed, and we in the armoury at Hemswell of 144 squadron were given the responsibility through the flight sergeant for indenting for the stores for this new squadron. This is how it was done in the old days. So we had to go through the armoury inventory and indent through the stores in order that the stores could make a whole task to send all the equipment to the squadron. So in the interim period between February 37 and April 38, A, we did our training, and B, somewhere along that line, it must have been about Christmas time, 1937, we were, 113 Squadron were told that they were going to be re-equipped with Blenheim aircraft. Having said that, being, inverted commas, an experienced air gunner with some navigational experience.
Hang on, do you mean 144 Squadron were?
No.
The new squadron were going to be equipped with?
144 Squadron. Right,
yeah.
We're going to get Blenheims. Sorry, I misunderstood that. It's 114. We got the Blenheims, actually. And we flew the Blenheims from Hemswell for between Christmas 37 and April, when I went abroad, right?
So how did they differ in any way from the prototype? Or
oh, yeah, entirely different. The prototype was...
It was a civilian aircraft, the prototype, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was exclusively. It was a Type 142, I think it was called. It was different, because when it became an actual military aircraft, it was partially redesigned. It became a mid-wing aircraft, apart from a low-wing aircraft. You know, and the interior wasn't furnished. It had... position for a pilot and navigator. I had a turret fitted on the back. and Bombay. So coming to that, we were notified that 144 Squadron were to get Blenheims. We were about the 7th Squadron in the Air Force at that time to get them. And being one of the navigators, oblique air crew guys, I was selected to go with one of the pilots to Filton, Bristol, to pick up the aircraft. And I remember it was at Christmas time because we were late in getting back. And the guy was a Canadian, F.C. Stibbard. I remember him very well. But I was a young sprog. I was only just turned 18. I hadn't been around. But he took me down, picked up our flying gear, and we went down by train to London. And he booked us into some residential place in, oh dear, I'll come back to that. I can't remember the square. Well-known square in London. And he said, well, they've got a Turkish bath there. He said, well, go. It's a flying officer and a young aircraftsman first class. So we went trips across the road to this Turkish bath. I can't remember the square.
Doesn't matter.
He'll come back to me, the square. Well known, still there, I think. And he introduced me to this Turkish bath, and God, it was quite out of this world, actually, as a young lad. Anyway, we had our Turkish bath and our pommeling by the masseur, and then a cold plunge, oh, truth. And then back, we crashed out for a while, and then eventually we went back to the hotel and got billets, and then off we went down to Bristol. And at Bristol, he checked over the aircraft, and I got my maps out, and then we were held up because of the weather, so we had to stay there for a couple of days. And eventually we got this into this aircraft and flew it off. Now, it was only the pilot and myself. There was no gunner, no turret, and this aircraft was a shadow-built. No, it was a Bristol-built aircraft, and it was fast, really was fast. Going from, it was twice as fast as we normally flew. And, I mean, the maps weren't big enough. We were running out of paper so quickly. Anyway, we managed to get back all right, and we did our landings. And so there we were. Here we were with this brand spanking new monoplane. So all the pilots crowded round, and he briefed them, and everybody was briefing, and we did a few exercises. They did the circus and bumps, circus and landings, the pilots, and then eventually they went and collected, and we got more. Eventually finished up swapping our odd axes for these Blenheims. Now, it took a little bit of while, but the armament, as far as the armourers were concerned, was straightforward. It had a bomb sight, it had a signal pistol, it had two flare racks on each side and a bomb racks, and they didn't have turrets fitted, but the turrets were ultimately to be fitted. There was a space for them, but there was ballast and lube, and we had the bombing capability, practice bombs. So we used to do the bombing and on the airfield, and I became, with my experience, I keep on coming back to this, because all the time the hours are mounting up, I was selected to indoctrinate the other UT guys, which was easy, as an armourer. And we did some low-level bombing on the airfield in these days. They had a big white circle on the aircraft, and you could, and we did quite well. We were getting 11 and 12 yards, you know, which was for 500 feet, that was. At this height and speed, it was quite phenomenal. The first two or three bombs weren't very good, mind you, but we soon latched onto the fact that they were. However, to cut a long story short, they had a peculiar armament set up, as I said.
The low-level bombing train, that was actually over the airfield.
Oh, yes, it was up in the corner, one corner of the airfield. A bit awe-inspiring, because you didn't know initially what to expect. Anyway, they all landed on the airfield, so it didn't matter. But the